Welcome back. In today's lecture, we're going to be looking at two closely related topics, leisure and entertainment. There's obvious overlap, but they're certainly not the same. Though neither the Greeks nor the Romans had anything equivalent to a weekend, they certainly appreciated the importance of time off. The philosopher Democritus of Abdera was a town in Thrace, who lived in the second half of the 5th century BC, observed that, I quote, "A life uninterrupted by festivals is like undertaking a long journey without stops along the way," end of quote. Democritus was known as the laughing philosopher, partly because he put such a high premium on happiness, euthumie, and partly because he couldn't help laughing at the follies of mankind. It's good to know that there were philosophers around in the ancient world who took a relaxed view of life. And Aristotle, too, in the Politics, wrote, "Everyone admits that leisure is a necessity both for the development of virtue and for the undertaking of affairs relating to the polis." End of quote. To begin with, however, what do we mean by leisure? Or better, how do we apply our modern concept of leisure to antiquity? Let's start with the terminology. In Greek, the nearest word for leisure is skole. It's the word which Aristotle uses in the passage I just quoted. It gives us our word skul, a meaning which, roughly speaking, it also held in antiquity. And that's because having leisure meant having the time, the ability, and the means to engage in learned discussion, to hear lectures, and to devote one's spare moments to philosophical discourse. Skole, in other words, which originally meant leisure of any sort, came in time to denote a particular kind of leisure activity associated with intellectual pursuits, though it never lost its original broader meaning. Its antithesis, askolia, the lack or absence of leisure, meant what we would call today work. Now, the fact that the concept of work was expressed in this negative form tells us a great deal about the Greek perception of leisure. Leisure, the Greek language is saying, was the normal state of affairs, whereas work was the abnormal state of affairs. Leisure wasn't mere idleness, however. Rather, it was having free time, A, to direct one's energies towards what we would call today self-improvement, and B, most importantly, to fulfill one's obligations as a citizen. In democratic societies, it meant hanging out in the agora, the communal meeting space in the heart of the city. There was actually a Greek word for to hang out in the agora, agoradzane. The agora was a peculiarly Greek institution and space, and it would be useful to say a few words about it here. It doesn't have an exact Roman equivalent, although forum comes close. But a forum did not engage the Roman citizen in quite the same way as the agora did the Greek citizen. Physically, it was a level, open space, and the agora in Athens lay directly to the north of the Acropolis. The word literally means high part of the polis, to which it was functionally related. The Acropolis was the home of the most venerable cults, including those of Athena Polias, Athena of the polis, the city, and of Poseidon Erechtheus. The agora also housed a number of cults, though not of such antiquity. Probably the most important was the cult of the 10 eponymous heroes, the heroes, in other words, who had given their names to the 10 Athenian tribes and who were first worshipped in the late 5th century BC. It was the place where all manner of interchanges between citizens took place, including those of a political, legal, commercial, philosophical, or simply social nature. Now let's look at the view of leisure and work that was held by the Romans. We'll see that it was rather similar to the Greeks. The Latin word for leisure is otium. Negotium was the lack or absence of otium, activity, business, and so forth. It's clear from this that neither society was burdened by the famous Protestant work ethic that drives Americans to work so hard. There was simply no particular point in working because manual labor was done by slaves. Cooking, cleaning, fetching and carrying, shopping, tending the garden, babysitting, nursing, sewing, taking down correspondence, etc., etc. And the second reason why there was no Protestant work ethic was because the vast majority of people were pretty content with their economic status, or at least did not entertain grandiose dreams of becoming rich. They weren't driven by the need to better themselves, as we are. I'm not talking about everyone. I'm not particularly talking about freedmen. They were probably driven by a desire to succeed in life. But most freeborn Greeks and Romans would not have understood what we meant by that. And if they had, they would have scorned it, succeeding in life, in those terms. In Roman society, where the client-patron system prevailed, there was a huge class of citizens who idled, as we would say, their lives away, paying court to their wealthy patrons, rather than going out and earning money. They did so because they scorned to do work, and because they thought the Roman Empire, in a sense, owed them a living. Hence the panem et circenses mentality, the expectation on the part of the urban plebs that they would receive free handouts of corn, panem, and regular gladiatorial entertainment in the circuses, circenses. The term panem et circenses was coined by the satirist Juvenal, who wrote, I quote, "The anxious Roman desires only two things, bread and circuses," end of quote. It's one of the earliest statements about entertainment serving as a kind of social sedative to mollify the masses and to keep them under control. However, and this is very important to note, both societies put a much higher value on citizenship and on fulfilling one's duties to the state than we do. So how did the Greeks and the Romans occupy themselves when they knocked off from work, assuming that they did indeed work? Those at the lower end of the economic and social ladder, too poor to own any slaves, probably had a simple dinner and then tumbled exhausted into bed. The well-to-do, by contrast, would have had a considerable amount of leisure time available to them. The most popular daytime venue for young Greek males was the gymnasium. This was a kind of leisure centre which comprised a wrestling ground, a running track and bars. But many gymnasia possessed a lecture room as well. The two most famous gymnasia in Athens were the Academy, the home of Platonic philosophy, and the Lyceum, the home of Aristotelian philosophy. Though originally gymnasia were places where ephebes, that's to say young men on the verge of manhood, that's the meaning of the word, would train before becoming hoplites, heavily armed infantrymen, over the course of time, they acquired an educational function as well, and as a result, older men came to frequent them as well. The nearest Roman equivalent of a leisure centre was the baths, and some of these were vast in scale, like the baths in Rome that were paid for by the emperors Trajan in AD 105, Caracalla, AD 215, and Diocletian, AD 305. As well as possessing hot halls, warm halls, and cold halls, they were provided with snack bars and art galleries, as well as spaces where ball games and other recreational activities could take place. Bars are a particularly interesting phenomenon in the history of social interactions in the Roman world, because they provided the one context where members of all social classes would literally rub shoulders together. They were a distinctly Roman phenomenon, and there was nothing like them in the Greek-speaking world. Although the inspiration for bathhouses came from the Greeks, Roman baths were enormous by comparison with their Greek counterparts, which accommodated at most a few dozen. Another way in which Greeks and Romans could relax was by joining a club. In the classical period, clubs almost invariably had a religious dimension, but as time passed, they took on a much broader function. They proliferated in the Hellenistic era and were particularly numerous in trading centres like the Piraeus or on the island of Delos and Rhodes, where they served to facilitate commercial ties as well as social ties. Some were intended to further the worship of a particular deity, others were burial societies, which guaranteed that their members would receive due burial and cult. They provided foreigners who lived in a particular community with a means to associate together. What was common to them all, however, was that they provided a context in which like-minded individuals could socialize, do business deals, arrange marriage contracts, gossip, enjoy a good meal, and simply pass the time. And they also provided a context in which citizens and foreigners, Greeks and non-Greeks, and perhaps even slave and free, could occasionally associate together. Taverns were plentiful in the Greco-Roman world, though we have virtually no evidence for what Brits call the pub culture. It must have existed to some degree, but the preferred social venue, at least for the well-to-do, was the symposium, or drinking party, literal meaning a drinking together. A symposium took place in a private house, ideally in a specially designed room with couches placed beside the walls, since custom dictated that the guests did not sit in chairs but reclined. The Latin equivalent was the convivium, which means literally a living together, or as we would probably phrase it today, a hanging out together. The convivium was borrowed directly from the Greek symposium, although, as we shall see, it had a distinctively Roman flavour. But the symposium was, as an institution, not invented by the Greeks. They adopted it from the Near East, perhaps around 700 BC. It was highly ritualized. It began and ended with prayers, and the drinking was strictly regulated. In charge of the proceedings was the symposiarch, or master of drinking, whose task was to determine the quantity and strength of alcohol, wine, that the Greeks would consume. The Greeks, like the Romans, never drank unmixed wine, but diluted it with water. And the symposiarch also got to choose the form of entertainment. This meant that a symposium could take a variety of forms depending on the temperament, age, social class, proclivities, even mood of the guests. The symposium could take the form of a highly cultivated encounter between philosophers, as in the case of Plato's Symposium, where the guests deliver impromptu speeches on the topic of love. Or it could be a thoroughly dissolute gathering, where the drink overflowed and where the guests indulged in sexual foreplay and more, as we know from Greek vase paintings. In Sparta, its equivalent was the phaedition, or meal that was shared by companions in the same military unit. It was a context in which Spartan values would be reinforced through edifying anecdotes designed to promote male bonding. The drinking party was, in short, the primary vehicle by which culture was transmitted, however broadly we define the word culture. Much of what I've been saying was equally true of the Roman convivium. There were, however, a number of important differences between the Greek and Roman drinking party. First, no respectable Greek woman was permitted to attend a symposium. Their place was taken by female companions, or hetairai, some of whom were hired for their conversational skills, others as prostitutes, and many, no doubt, on both counts. The Romans, by contrast, from the regal period onwards, permitted respectable women to attend the convivium. Second, the convivium was a much more hierarchical affair than the Greek symposium, reflecting the class structure of Roman society. Precedence would be given to those of rank, whereas at the Greek symposium, social distinctions were de-emphasized. And third, the Romans tended to place more emphasis on the eating than on the drinking. Overall, the Roman convivium may therefore have sought to promote more moderate behavior, though there were no doubt many exceptions. The most famous literary exception is the fabled party hosted by a super-rich and thoroughly vulgar freedman called Trimalchio, who features in the Satyricon, a novel by Petronius, which we'll be talking about in a later lecture. As we noted at the beginning, there was nothing equivalent to the weekend in antiquity. Indeed, the week, as we understand it, had not been invented. It may have been introduced in the late Roman Empire, but we don't know that for certain. So the days when public business was suspended were dictated by the religious calendar, both in Greece and in Rome. And it was on these days that major state-sponsored festivals would be held. Their number varied from community to community, and not all of them would have been observed by every member of the community, but the most important ones would have been attended by a majority of the population, not least because these were occasions when meat, the meat from the sacrificial animals, would be distributed. Over the course of time, the number of days off increased in the Roman Empire. Under the Emperor Claudius, AD 41 to 54, 159 days of the year were identified as public holidays, 93 of which were given over to what we would call entertainment. Well, so much for leisure. Let's now turn to the subject of entertainment. Entertainment isn't a word that features in either Greek or Latin, nor is there any word that's really equivalent. Well, I'm going to use it here to encapsulate a whole host of activities that involved spectatorship. In the Greek world, rather less so in the Roman world, one of the most popular forms of spectatorship were the athletic contests. The most prestigious games were the four great Panhellenic festivals, festival that is, that were celebrated by all Greeks, irrespective of their specific ethnic allegiance. All four were associated with major sanctuaries situated in southern central Greece and the northern Peloponnese, the Olympic Games, held in honour of Zeus at Olympia, the Pythian Games in honour of Apollo at Delphi, the Isthmian Games in honour of Poseidon at Corinth, and the Nemean Games, also in honour of Zeus at Nemea. One of the four took place every year so that successful athletes were in continuous competition with one another. The prize in each case was a simple crown of leaves. The events included foot raising, boxing, wrestling, pancratian, that was a combination of boxing, wrestling, and judo, hoplitodromos, a race in hoplite or heavy armour, pentathlon, horse racing, chariot racing, but they also incorporated musical contests involving playing of music, etc., such as flute playing, lyre playing, singing, tragedy, comedy, and satiric drama. In addition, there were competitions in the composition and recitation of epic verse, and later in the writing of panegyrics, including panegyrics in honour of the emperor. How much fun, I wonder, was it listening to those? Very long and windy, I imagine, especially if the subject of the panegyric happened to be present. I mentioned drama a moment ago, and arguably the most prestigious venue for drama was the city Dionysia in Athens, at which both tragedies and comedies were performed. Theatre, however, was not an all-the-year-round option, of course. It was confined to only a few festival days in the year. Plays were state-sponsored and performed only once, though in time revivals became commonplace. In the Greek world, the citizen body sat in tribes. In Athens, the 10 tribes, which gave theatrical performance a truly civic flavour, something which is entirely lacking in the contemporary world. And Roman drama had a similar association with religion. From 214 BC onwards, 4 days were devoted to drama at the Ludi Romani, or Roman Games, and over time the number grew, though Roman drama never had a civic flavour to it in the way that Greek drama did. In one important respect, entertainment presents a very sharp divide between the Greeks and the Romans. The Greeks don't seem to have had any appetite for seeing people butcher one another, whether acted out on stage or conducted for real in the amphitheatre. The Romans, by contrast, had an inexhaustible appetite, not just for ketchup, so to speak, but for the real stuff. This explains, in part, the popularity of gladiatorial combat and other such abominations, including throwing prisoners to the beasts or conducting public executions. Such events were hugely popular. The Colosseum, Rome's premier amphitheatre, could accommodate 50,000. Artificial battlefields in cities and towns is what Keith Hopkins calls such amphitheatres. Gladiatorial combat originated as a way of honouring the dead at aristocratic funerals, and it never entirely lost its religious component, as Hopkins goes on to argue, in that it resembled a type of human sacrifice. The emperors regularly resorted to gladiatorial combat as a favourite means of currying favour with the plebs. The peak of its popularity occurred in the reign of the Emperor Trajan, in AD 107, when 5,000 pairs of gladiators and 10,000 beasts were rounded up to celebrate his conquest of the Dacians. But it was much more popular in the Western, i.e. Latin-speaking half of the empire, than in the Eastern, Greek-speaking half, reflecting the differing attitudes towards such spectacles on the part of the Romans and the Greeks. A second difference is that there was probably a lot more going on in the Roman world that could be classified as entertainment than there had been in earlier times, though the Hellenistic period certainly saw an increase over the preceding classical period. The comic dramatist Terence, in the prologue to his play called Hekira or the Mother-in-Law, tells us that when he first tried to put his play on, he had to abandon the production because the audience learnt that some famous boxers and a tightrope walker were about to perform elsewhere, and so they vacated the theatre. And then when Terence tried to mount his play the second time, the audience got up and left to attend a gladiatorial contest instead. I'd like to look next at the showbiz personalities of the ancient world, some of whom were able to achieve a degree of celebrity that was not unlike that accorded to modern pop stars and the like. Not surprisingly, perhaps, in light of the antiquity of their tradition, the Greeks virtually monopolized many forms of entertainment, as rhapsodes, as actors, as mimes, and as pantomimes. I'll begin by talking about the rhapsodes, solo performers who recited or chanted excerpts from Homer to the accompaniment of a lyre-like instrument. Rhapsodes first began competing in Athens around the middle of the 6th century BC. This might not strike us as a particularly riveting form of entertainment, but Socrates, in Plato's dialogue The Ion, likened the effect of their recitations upon their audiences to something akin to Bacchic possession. A Beatlemania might be the nearest modern equivalent. We're told that audiences in excess of 20,000 flocked to hear them when they competed in the games. Though it seems rather doubtful whether they appealed much to Roman taste, we do know that they were still competing in the 3rd century AD, so they had a pretty long run for their money, some 800 years in all. The Greeks also shined as actors. The heyday of the actor was in the Hellenistic period, during which there occurred a huge growth throughout the Greek-speaking world in the number and size of public spaces dedicated to the display of theatrical talent. And there was a comparable increase in the number of theatrical competitions. The big acting stars were hired to perform at festivals, or rather they were offered handsome prizes to do so, sometimes competing without any competitors. They might also give performances outside the festival structure, or perhaps at the houses of the very wealthy. And they came to focus on particular parts that they would be asked to do again and again. With the exception of royalty, star actors probably became the best known as well as the best loved personages of the age. The Romans, by contrast, took a rather dim view of actors, as indicated by the fact that the manager of a theatrical troupe was sometimes referred to as the dominus gregis, or master of the herd. They didn't allow actors to serve in the army or to vote, and they could be imprisoned, beaten, or exiled without having recourse to due legal process. Roman contempt for actors may well have had something to do with racial stereotyping, since it was Greeks predominantly who excelled in this profession. Greeks, as every Roman schoolboy knew, were tricky, and their talent for acting was a manifestation of their talent for mendacity. That's surely one of the chief reasons why the city of Rome didn't acquire a permanent stone theatre until around the middle of the 1st century BC, the gift of Pompey the Great. Some Roman actors did, however, become both famous and extremely wealthy, so there was a degree of ambivalence in the Roman mind towards them, as in so many other areas of their cultural interaction with the Greeks. The most famous Roman actor of all time was Quintus Roscius Gallus, a name that still resonates to this day in acting circles. Roscius's status was such that he was on intimate terms both with the dictator Sulla and with the orator and politician Cicero. He's said to have earned 500,000 sesterces in 1 year, a fabulous sum of money. Though drama continued to occupy a fairly important place in the world of Roman entertainment in the period of the empire, by the end of the 1st century BC, its popularity was being overshadowed by two new forms of entertainment to which it was somewhat related. These are called mime and pantomime, and they both originated in the Greek-speaking world. Mime artists acted without words. Their movements and gestures were accompanied by singing, dancing, or music, and their routines were inspired both by folklore and by tales taken from real life. Their movements were often erotic, not to say lewd. And female mime artists probably performed the ancient equivalent of a striptease. Mime was performed in theatres, amphitheatres, even hippodromes, which indicate that it must have attracted very large audiences indeed. The most distinguished mime artists were Greek and achieved a high status. Some even had access to the imperial court. We hear of one named Mnesta, who was first the lover of Poppaea Sabina, Nero's mother-in-law, and later of Claudius's wife, Messalina, and of another named Halitiras, who had sufficient clout to secure an interview with Caligula on behalf of an embassy from Judea. But the most famous mime of all, probably she was a mime, might have been a pantomime, which I'll talk about later, was Theodora, later to become the wife of the Emperor Justinian, who reigned AD 527 to 65. And that's compelling testimony both to the enduring popularity of this form of entertainment and to the fact that it was popular not only among the lower orders, but also among the elite. Pantomime artists were a more sophisticated variant on mime artists. They were solo dancers who mimed all the characters of a story to a musical accompaniment. And these stories were usually drawn from mythology. Pantomime was introduced into Rome in the reign of Augustus, and the most famous pantomime artist was Pylades, a Greek, who lived in the reign of Augustus. He was very popular, as we see from the fact that at least five other artists later called themselves Pylades over the next two centuries, evidently hoping to emulate his popularity. Yet again, as we see from the names, it's Greeks who dominated this profession. It's tempting to speculate whether part of the popularity of mime and pantomime in the imperial period derived from the fact that they both catered to the needs of a polyglot population, which obviously drama did not. I saved the biggest attraction, chariot racing, for last. In the Greek world, chariot racing was already the most popular event at the games. Who could resist all those high-speed chases? Now, chariot racing was all the more dangerous in the Greek world, however, because the charioteer only had a turning point to navigate around, not a solid divider down the middle of the track. And he could approach it from either side, which meant that head-on collisions were not uncommon. The Romans, by contrast, had a solid divider, thereby eliminating the danger of head-on collisions. In the Roman period, chariot racing took on a totally different character from its Greek counterpart and became by far the most popular form of entertainment. Two of the main differences from the Greeks were, one, there was a focus upon the charioteer, some of whom became superstars. In the Greek world, it was the owner of the victorious team of horses who was crowned the victor. And two, chariot teams were associated with four stables, the greens, the blues, the whites, and the reds, so that chariot racing also had the feel of a team event. It's estimated by the late 1st century AD, the Circus Maximus in Rome, the premier venue for this sporting activity, could accommodate 250,000 people. It wasn't just in the West where chariot racing was popular. Some of the largest hippodromes were in the East, particularly Alexandria, Antioch, Berytus, Caesarea, Maritima, Carthage, Constantinople. And not surprisingly, emotions sometimes ran wild given the huge size of the audience. We hear of numerous riots between the fans of the various chariot teams. None was more serious than the riot which broke out in Constantinople in AD 531 during the reign of the Emperor Justinian. It reputedly left 30,000 people dead, and it very nearly brought down the empire in consequence. Charioteers earned fabulous sums. We hear of one named Publius Aelius Gutta Calpurnianus, great name, who in a single race earned almost the equivalent of half the annual salary of the tutor to Augustus's grandsons. Some things never change. To conclude, the investigation of leisure has revealed many similarities between Greek and Roman culture, notably in what was no doubt the most popular way of relaxing, the drinking party, although there were important differences here as well. Turning to entertainment, we discovered further strong similarities, though it is noteworthy that the Greeks tended to dominate the world of showbiz, and further, that the Roman taste for witnessing killing found no echo among the Greeks. In the next lecture, we're going to investigate a topic not unconnected with leisure and entertainment, namely sex and sexuality. And we will discover that even in this most intimate and private aspect of human identity, the Romans were by no means immune to Greek practices and Greek ideas.